What's going on? He snarled. Who did this? Irene Laws had reached the edge of the grave, moving as fast as her short, stubby legs would allow. Mr. Cooper, she began, breathlessly. Is this some sort of joke? Damien looked ill. Why are they playing that song? Raise the coffin. Irene had taken charge. Lift it back out again. Move on back. Move on back. I want you to know, I am going to sue your fucking company for every penny. I'm most dreadfully sorry.
Irene was talking over him.
I just don't understand.
The four men pulled the coffin back out rather faster than they had lowered it. It came clear over the edge of the grave and bumped onto the grass, almost toppling onto its side. I can imagine Diana Cooper inside, being rocked to and fro. I examined the other mourners, wondering if one of them was responsible, for presumably this had been done deliberately. Was it a sick joke? Was it some sort of message? Raymond Clunes was clutching onto his partner. Bruno Wang was staring, his hand over his mouth. Andrea Kluvanek, I could have been wrong, but she seemed to be smiling. Next to her, the man with a handkerchief was gazing at the coffin with an expression I couldn't make out at all. He brought his hand to his mouth as if he was going either to throw up or to burst into laughter, then twisted round and backed away. I watched him as he hurried out of the cemetery, heading up the path that would lead him to the Brompton Road.
The driver on the bus goes, move on back, all day long.
It wouldn't stop. That was the worst of it. The music was so trite, the voice full of that hideous cheerfulness that adults put on when they sing for children.
I've had enough of this, Damien announced.
From the look of him, he was in total shock. It was the first real emotion he had shown since the funeral began.
Damien?
Grace reached out to take his arm. He shook her off.
I'm going home. You go to the pub. I'll see you at the flat.
I was aware of the photographers snapping with their cameras, their long-distance lenses protruding obscenely over the gravestones. The personal trainer-cum-bodyguard was doing his best to stand in the way, but the lenses swiveled to follow Damien as he stormed off. The vicar turned to Irene, helpless.
"What should we do?" she asked. "Let's take the coffin back to the chapel."
Irene was trying not to lose her composure.
"Quickly!"
she snapped in an undertone. The pallbearers picked Diana Cooper up and carried her back across the grass, away from the grave, moving as quickly as they could without actually running, still trying to display some measure of decorum. They weren't succeeding. They looked ridiculous, I thought, moving out of sync, bumping into each other and almost tripping over in their haste to get away. The tinkling music faded into the distance.
The horn on the bus goes.
Hawthorne watched them disappear. I could almost see the different thoughts turning over in his head.
Beep, beep, beep,
he muttered tunelessly, then set off at a brisk pace, following the coffin back towards the chapel. 12. The Smell of Blood. We had left the other mourners standing in a confused circle around the empty grave as we set off after the coffin, which now reminded me of a tiny ship being tossed around in a stormy sea. I had a suspicion that Hawthorne was amused by what had happened. It might be that the bleak, vindictive joke, if that's what it was, had appealed to the darker side of his nature. More likely, it was the knowledge that the theory Meadows had put forward had been completely blown apart. Just a few minutes ago, he had been talking about a burglary that had gone wrong. There was no question of that now. Everything that had happened had pushed the crime far outside normal police experience and gave Hawthorne all the more opportunity to call the investigation his own. I looked back and saw Meadows lumbering after us, but for the time being, Hawthorne and I were alone as we headed towards the chapel, which lay a short way ahead.
What do you think that was all about? I asked.
It was a message, Hawthorne said.
A message? Who for?
Well, Damien Cooper, for one. You saw his face.
He was upset.
That's putting it mildly. He was white as a bloody sheet. I thought he was going to pass out.
This has got to be about Jeremy Godwin,
I said. He wasn't run over by a bus.
No, but maybe he was carrying a toy bus when he was hit. Maybe he liked travelling on buses.
You're right about one thing, mate. It was a kiddie's nursery rhyme, so it's likely to have something to do with a dead kiddie.
Hawthorne stepped delicately over a grave.
Damien's gone home, he went on. But we'll catch up with him soon enough. I wonder what he's got to say.
It's been 10 years since the accident in Deal, I was thinking out loud. First Diana Cooper is killed, then this. Someone's certainly trying to make a point. We had reached the chapel. The coffin had already gone in. We waited until Meadows caught up with us.
I always knew things would go pear-shaped once you were involved, he grunted.
He was terribly out of shape. Even the short walk had left him breathless. If he didn't watch his diet, quit smoking and take exercise, he would soon be back in the cemetery for a more permanent visit.
I'll be interested to hear how your burglar pulled this one off, Hawthorne said.
I can't say I've noticed anyone dressed up as a dispatch rider.
What happened here may have nothing to do with the murder, and you know it, Meadows replied. There's a Hollywood celebrity involved. It was a practical joke, someone with a twisted mind, that's all.
You might be right.
Hawthorne's tone of voice made it clear he didn't believe a word of it. We went into the chapel. By now, the coffin was back on the trestles, and Irene Laws was busily undoing the straps, watched by the vicar, wide-eyed with shock, and the four men from Cornwallis and Sons. She looked up as we came in.
"I've been in this business for 27 years, she said, "and nothing like this, nothing, has ever happened before."
At least the nursery rhyme music had stopped. I heard only the creak of willow as Irene finished her work and lifted the lid. I flinched. I had no desire to see Diana Cooper a week after she had died. Fortunately, she was covered by a muslin shroud, and although I could make out the shape of her body, I was spared the sight of the staring eyes or the sewn-together lips. Irene leant in and removed what looked like a bright orange cricket ball which had been placed between Diana Cooper's hands. She handed it to Meadows. He examined it with distaste.
"I don't know what this is," he said.
"It's an alarm clock."
Hawthorne reached out, and Meadows handed it to him, glad to be rid of it. I saw that it was indeed a digital alarm clock, with the correct time displayed in a circular panel on one side. It had a number of perforations, like an old-fashioned radio, and 2 switches. Hawthorne flicked one of them up, and it began again.
"The wheels on the bus go round and round."
"Turn it off!"
Irene Laws shuddered.
He did as she asked.
"It's an MP3 recording alarm clock," he explained. "There are plenty of them on the internet.
The idea is you can download your kid's favourite song so it wakes them up in the morning.
I got one for my boy, except I put my own voice on it. Wake up, you little bastard, and get a move on." He thinks it's hilarious.
"How was it activated?" I asked. Hawthorne turned it over in his hands.
"It was set for 11:30. Whoever put it there timed it to go off in the middle of the funeral. They couldn't have done a better job."
He rounded on Irene Laws.
"Have you got an explanation for how it got there?" he asked.
"No."
She was taken aback, as if he was accusing her.
"Was the coffin left on its own at any time?"
"You'd really have to ask Mr. Cornwallis."
Hawthorne paused.
"Where is Cornwallis?"
"He had to leave early. It's his son's school play this afternoon."
She was staring at the orange ball.
"Nobody in our company would have done something like this."
"Then it must have been someone from outside. Hence my question, was the coffin left on its own?"
"Yes."
Irene squirmed, hating to admit it.
"The deceased was laid out at our facility on the Fulham Palace Road. She was brought from there today. Unfortunately, we don't have enough space at our South Kensington office. We have a chapel close to Hammersmith Roundabout, a place of bereavement. Members of the family and close friends would have been able to visit Mrs. Cooper if they so wished."
"And how many of them so wished?"
"I can't tell you now, but we have a visitor's book, and nobody would have been allowed in without some form of identification."
"How about here at the cemetery?"
Hawthorne asked. Irene said nothing, so we went on.
When we arrived, the coffin was inside the hearse, which was parked around the back. Was there someone there the whole time?
Irene deflected the question to one of the pallbearers, who shuffled his feet and looked down.
We were there most of the time, he muttered, but not all of it.
And who are you?
Alfred Laws. I'm a director of the company. He took a breath.
Irene is my wife.
Hawthorne smiled mirthlessly.
Keep it all in the family, don't you? So where were you?
When we first arrived, we parked the vehicle and came in here.
All of you?
Yes.
And was the hearse locked?
No.
In our experience, nobody has ever tried to remove a dead person, Irene remarked icily.
Well, maybe that's something you should think about in the future.
Hawthorne closed in on her, almost menacing.
I'll need to talk to Mr. Cornwallis. Where can I find him?
I'll give you his address.
Irene held out a hand, and her husband passed her a notebook and a pen. She scribbled a few lines on the first page, then tore it out and handed it to Hawthorne.
Thank you. Wait a minute.
Meadows had been standing to one side throughout all this, and it was as if he had only just realised he hadn't said anything. At the same time, I saw it in his eyes, he knew he had nothing more to say.
I'll take the alarm clock,
he muttered, asserting his authority.
It shouldn't have been handled,
he added, forgetting that he had been the one who had taken it from Irene in the first place.
Forensics aren't going to like that.
I doubt forensics will find very much, Hawthorne said.
Well, if it was bought on the internet, there's a good chance we'll be able to find the identity of the purchaser.
Hawthorne handed it to him. Meadows made a point of gripping it very carefully, with his thumb and second finger each side of the digital clock.
Good luck,
Hawthorne said. It was a dismissal. The wake, if that was what it was being held at a gastropub on the corner of Finborough Road, a few minutes' walk from the cemetery. This was the place that Damien had mentioned before he had stormed off. He wasn't the only one who had gone straight home. Half the mourners had decided to give it a miss, too. That left Grace Lavelle and about a dozen men and women hitting the Prosecco and miniature sausages, trying to console each other not just on the loss of an old friend, but on the terrible farce that a funeral had become. Hawthorne had said he wanted to talk to Damien Cooper, and he'd already called through to Robert Cornwallis, leaving a message on his mobile phone. But first of all, he wanted to catch up with the other mourners. After all, if they hadn't known Diana Cooper well, they wouldn't have come to the funeral, and it was his one chance to catch them while they were all together. There was a definite spring in his step as we crossed the Fulham Road and went in. Any sort of mystery energised him, and the more bizarre the better. We saw Grace straight away. Although she was wearing black, her dress was very short, and she had a velvet tuxedo jacket with extravagantly padded shoulders. Leaning against the bar, she could just as easily have come from a film premiere as a funeral. She wasn't talking to anyone, and smiled anxiously as we came over to her.
Mr. Hawthorne, she was clearly glad to see him. I don't know what I'm doing here. I hardly know any of these people.
Who are they?
Hawthorne asked. She looked around, then pointed.
That's Raymond Clunes. He's a theatre producer. Damien was in one of his plays.
We've met.
And that's Diana's GP?
She nodded at a man in his 60s, pigeon-shaped, in a dark three-piece suit.
His name's Dr. Butterworth, I think. The woman next to him is his wife. The man standing in the corner is Diana's lawyer, Charles Kenworthy. He's dealing with the will, but I don't know anyone else.
Damien went home.
He was very upset. That song was deliberately chosen to upset him. It was a horrible joke to play.
You know about the song?
Well, yes,
she hesitated, unsure if she could continue.
It goes back to that horrible business with those two children, she said. It was Timothy Godwin's favourite song. They played it when they buried him, in Harrow Weald.
How do you know that?
Hawthorne asked.
Damien told me. He often talked about it.
For some reason, she felt a need to defend him.
He's not someone to show his feelings, but it really mattered to him what happened all those years ago.
She had a glass of Prosecco and drained it.
Gosh, what a horrible day. I knew it was going to be horrible when I woke up this morning, but I never dreamed it would be anything like this.
Hawthorne was examining her.
I got the impression you didn't much like Damien's mother,
he said suddenly. Grace blushed, the straight lines at the very top of her cheekbones darkening.
That's not true. Who told you that?
You said she ignored you.
I said nothing of the sort. She was just more interested in Ashley, that's all.
Where is Ashley?
In Hounslow, at my parents' place. I'm picking her up when I leave here.
She put her glass down on the bar and picked up another one from a passing waiter.
So you were close to her then, Hawthorne said.
I wouldn't say that,
she thought for a moment.
Damien and I had only been together for a short while before Ashley arrived, and she was nervous that being a father would hold him back.
She stopped herself.
I know how that sounds, but you have to understand that she was quite a lonely person. After Lawrence died, she only had Damien, and she doted on him. His success meant the world to her.
And the baby was in the way.
She wasn't planned, if that's what you mean, but Damien loves her now. He wouldn't have it any other way.
How about you, Miss Lavelle? Ashley can't have helped your career.
You do say the most unpleasant things, Mr. Hawthorne. I'm only 33. I love Ashley to bits. And it doesn't make any difference to me if I don't work for a few years. I'm very happy with the way things are.
She can't have been that good an actress, I thought. I certainly wasn't convinced by her now.
Do you enjoy Los Angeles?
Hawthorne asked.
It's taken me a while to get used to it. We have a house in the Hollywood Hills, and when I wake up in the morning, I can't believe I'm there. It was always my dream when I was at drama school to wake up and see the Hollywood sign.
I imagine you got lots of new friends.
I don't need new friends. I've got Damien.
She looked over Hawthorne's shoulder.
If you don't mind, I have to say hello to some of these people. I meant to be looking after everyone, and I don't want to stay too long.
She slipped away. Hawthorne followed her with his eyes. I could see his thoughts ticking over.
What now? I asked.
The doctor, he said.
Why him?
Hawthorne glanced at me tiredly.
Because he knew Diana Cooper inside out. Because if she had any problems, she may have talked to him. Because he may have been the one who killed her, I don't know.
Shaking his head, Hawthorne approached the man in the three-piece suit whom Grace had pointed out.
Dr. Butterworth, he said.
Buttermore.
The doctor shook hands. He was large, bearded, with gold-framed glasses, the sort of man who would happily describe himself as old school. It had offended him, Hawthorne getting his name wrong, but he warmed up a little once Hawthorne had explained his connection to Scotland Yard. I often notice this. People enjoy being drawn into a murder investigation. Part of them wants to help, but there's something salacious about it too.
So what was all that about back in the cemetery?
Buttermore asked.
I bet you've never seen anything like that, Mr. Hawthorne.
Poor Diana. God knows what she would have made of it.
You think it was done on purpose?
I wouldn't have thought anyone would have loaded an alarm clock into a coffin by accident, sir, Hawthorne said. I was grateful for the final sir, otherwise he would have sounded too obviously contemptuous.
Well, that's absolutely true. I take it you're going to look into it. Well, Mrs. Cooper's murder is my first priority.
I thought the culprit had already been identified.
A burglar,
his wife said. She was half the size of her husband, in her 50s, severe.
We have to explore every avenue, Hawthorne explained.
He turned back to the husband.
I understand you were a close friend of Mrs. Cooper, Dr. Buttermore. It would be helpful to know when you last saw her.
About 3 weeks ago.
She visited my surgery in Cavendish Square. She'd come in to see me quite a few times, as a matter of fact.
Recently.
Over the last few months. She was having trouble sleeping. It's quite common, actually, among women of a certain age. Although she was also having anxiety issues.
He glanced left and right, nervous of sharing confidential information in a public place. He lowered his voice.
She was worried about her son.
And why would that be? Hawthorne asked.
I'm speaking to you as her doctor as well as her friend, Mr. Hawthorne. The truth is,
that she was worried about his lifestyle in Los Angeles. She'd been opposed to his going in the first place, and then she'd read all these vile things in the gossip columns, drugs and parties and all the rest of it. Of course there wasn't an iota of truth in it. The newspapers will print rubbish and lies about anyone who's famous. That's what I told her, but she was clearly in a state, so I prescribed sleeping pills. Ativan to begin with, and later on, when that wasn't strong enough, temazepam. I remembered the pills that we'd found in the dead woman's bathroom. They seemed to do the trick. Buttermore went on. I last saw her, as I just mentioned, at the end of April. I gave her another prescription. You weren't afraid of her getting addicted? Dr. Buttermore smiled benignly. Forgive me, Mr. Hawthorne, but if you knew anything about medicine, you'd know there's very little chance of addiction with temazepam. It's one of the reasons I prescribe it. The only danger is short-term memory loss, but Mrs. Cooper seemed generally in excellent health. Did she talk to you about visiting a funeral parlour? I'm sorry? She went to a funeral parlour. She arranged her funeral the very same day she died. Dr. Buttermore blinked. I'm absolutely astonished. I can't think of any reason why she would have done that. I can assure you that apart from the anxiety problems, she had no reason to believe her health was in decline. I can only assume the timing of her death was a coincidence. It was a burglary, his wife insisted. Exactly, dear. She couldn't possibly have known it was going to happen. It was a coincidence, nothing more. Hawthorne nodded, and the two of us moved away. Fucking prat, he muttered as soon as we were out of earshot. Why do you say that? Because he didn't have a clue what he was talking about. I looked puzzled. You heard what he said. It didn't make any sense, Hawthorne said. It made sense to me. He's a prat. Just make sure you write that down. A fucking prat? I assume you'd like the expletive. Hawthorne said nothing. I'll just make sure it's clear it was you who said it, I added. That way, he can sue you instead of me. He can't sue anyone if it's the truth. We moved on to Charles Kenworthy, the lawyer. He was still in the corner, talking to a woman I assumed to be his wife. He was short and round, with curling silver hair. She was a similar shape, but heavier. The two of them could have come down to London from the country, as they both had a horsey quality, with ruddy cheeks from all that fresh air. He was drinking Prosecco. She had a fruit juice. How do you do? Yes, yes, I'm Charles Kenworthy. This is Frida. He could hardly have been more affable. As soon as Hawthorne had introduced himself, Kenworthy made it his business to tell us as much about himself as he could. He had known the dead woman for more than 30 years, and had been a close friend of Lawrence Cooper. Pancreatic cancer, absolutely shocking. He was a remarkable man, a first-rate dentist. He still lived in Kent, in Faversham. He had helped Diana sell the house after that dreadful business, and moved to London.
Did you advise her at the time of the trial? Hawthorne asked.
Absolutely. Kenworthy couldn't help himself. He didn't just talk, he gushed. There was no case against her. The judge was absolutely right.
Did you know him?
Weston. We'd met once or twice. A fair-minded chap. I told her she had nothing to worry about, no matter what the newspapers said. Still, it was a difficult time for her. She was very upset.
When did you last see her?
Well, last week, the day she died. At a board meeting. We were both on the board of the Globe Theatre. As you may know, the theatre is an educational charity. We rely very heavily on donations to be able to continue.
And what sort of plays do you put on?
Well, Shakespeare, obviously.
I wasn't sure if Hawthorne really was unaware that the Globe was a reconstruction of a theatre that had stood on the south bank of the Thames 400 years ago, and that it specialised in authentic performances of mainly Elizabethan plays. There was nothing about him that suggested he had any interest in drama, or, for that matter, literature, music, or art. At the same time, though, he was remarkably well-informed about a great many things, and it was quite possible that he was simply trying to get under the lawyer's skin.
I understand that you had a bit of an argument that day.
I wouldn't say so. Who told you that?
Hawthorne didn't answer. It was actually Robert Cornwallis, who had heard raised voices when he had called Diana Cooper to ask about plot numbers in Brompton Cemetery.
She resigned from the board, he said.
Well, yes, but that wasn't because of any particular disagreement.
So why did she resign?
I have no idea.
She simply said that she'd been thinking about it for some time and that she would leave with immediate effect. Her announcement took us all by surprise. She'd been a passionate supporter of the theatre and a driving force in our fundraising and educational programmes.
Was she unhappy about something?
Not at all. If anything, I would have said she was quite relieved. She'd been on the board for 6 years. Maybe she thought it was enough.
Next to him, his wife was becoming uneasy.
Charles, maybe we ought to be on our way.
All right, dear.
Kenworthy turned to Hawthorne.
I can't really tell you anything more about the board. It's confidential.
Can you tell me about Mrs. Cooper's will?
Well, yes, I'm sure that will become public knowledge soon enough. It's quite simple. She left everything to Damien.
From what I understand, that's quite a bit.
It's not for me to go into details. It's been very nice meeting you, Mr. Hawthorne.
Charles Kenworthy put down his glass. He fished in his pocket and handed a car key to his wife.
Off we go then, dear. You'd better drive.
Righty-ho.
The keys. Hawthorne was speaking to himself. His eyes were fixed on Charles and Frieda Kenworthy as they walked away, but at the same time he was no longer interested in them. His thoughts were elsewhere. Frieda was still holding the car key. I saw it in her hand as she went through the door, and realized that it had thrown some sort of switch, reminding Hawthorne of something he had missed. And then he worked it out. I actually saw the moment when it happened. It was almost shocking, as if he had been physically hit. I wouldn't say that the colour drained from his face, as there had never been much colour to begin with, but it was there in his eyes, the terrible realisation that he had got something wrong.
"We're going," he said.
"Where?"
"There's no time. Just move."
He was already on his way, pushing past a waiter, making for the door. We overtook the Kenworthys, who were saying goodbye to someone they knew, and burst out onto the street. We arrived at a corner, and Hawthorne came to a halt, seething with fury.
"Why are there no bloody taxis?"
He was right. Despite the heavy traffic, there wasn't a taxi in sight. But as we stood there, I saw one pull in on the other side of the road. It had been hailed by a woman carrying shopping bags. Hawthorne shouted, a single exclamation. At the same time, he ran across the road, blind to the traffic. Taking a little more care, I was remembering that the cemetery was just round the corner, I followed. There was the screech of tyres, the blast of a horn, but somehow I made it to the other side. Hawthorne had already interposed himself between the woman and the driver, who had clicked on the meter, turning off his yellow light.
"Excuse me,"
I heard the woman say, her voice rising with indignation.
"Police," Hawthorne snapped. "It's an emergency."
She didn't ask him for ID. Hawthorne had been in the police force long enough to have assumed its authority. Or maybe it was just that he looked too dangerous, somebody you wouldn't want to argue with.
"Where do you want to go?"
the driver asked as we both bundled in.
"Brick Lane,"
Hawthorne said. Damien Cooper's home. I will never forget that taxi journey. It was a few minutes past midday, and there wasn't actually that much traffic. But every snarl up, every red traffic light, was torture for Hawthorne, who sat hunched up next to me, almost writhing. There were all sorts of questions I wanted to ask him. What was it about a set of car keys that had alerted him? Why had they put him in mind of Damien Cooper? Was Damien in some sort of danger? But I was sensible enough to keep silent. I didn't want Hawthorne's anger to be turned on me, and I don't know why, but somewhere in the back of my mind, a voice was whispering that whatever was happening, it might somehow be my fault. It's a long way from Fulham to Brick Lane. We had to cross the whole of London, west to east, and it might have been faster to take the tube. We actually went past several stations, South Kensington, Knightsbridge, Hyde Park Corner, and each time I saw Hawthorne making the calculation, trying to work out the amount of traffic ahead. As we headed down towards Piccadilly, he took out some of his frustration on the driver.
"Why are you going this way? You should have gone past the bloody palace."
The driver ignored him. It was true that the traffic crawled as we came down towards Piccadilly Circus, but when you're in a hurry in London, every route will be the wrong one. I looked at my watch. It had so far taken us 25 minutes to get here. It felt a lot longer. Next to me, Hawthorne was muttering under his breath. I sat back and closed my eyes. He still hadn't told me what was actually going on. Eventually, we reached Damien Cooper's flat. Hawthorne leapt out, leaving me to pay. I handed the driver £50 and, without waiting for change, followed Hawthorne through the narrow doorway and staircase that led up between two shops. We reached the entrance on the first floor. Ominously, the door was ajar. We went in. It was the smell of blood that hit me first. I'd written about dozens of murders for books and television, but I had never imagined anything like this. Damien Cooper had been mutilated. He was lying on his side, in a puddle of dark brown blood that had spread all around him, seeping into the floorboards. One of his hands was stretched out, and the first thing I noticed was that two of his fingers had been half-severed as he had flailed out, trying to protect himself from the knife that had cut him half a dozen times, and which had finally been left sticking out of his chest. One of the blows had slashed him across the face, and this injury was more horrible than any of the others, because when we meet someone it's the first thing we look at. Lose an arm or a leg, and you are still you. Lose your face, and almost everything we know about you is taken away. Damien had a deep cut that had taken out one eye, and folded back a great flap of skin all the way down to his mouth. His clothes might hide the worst of his other injuries, but here there was no disguising the madness of what had been done to him. One of his cheeks was pressed against the floor, and his whole head had taken on the melting quality of a punctured football. He no longer looked anything like himself. I had really only recognized him by his clothes and the tangled black hair. The smell of his blood filled my nostrils. It was rich, deep, like freshly dug earth. I had never known that blood smelled like that, but then there was so much of it, and the flat was warm, the windows closed, the walls bending.
Tony! Come on, for Christ's sake!
For some reason, I was looking at the ceiling. The back of my head was hurting. Hawthorne was leaning over me. I opened my mouth to speak, then stopped myself. I couldn't have fainted. That was impossible. It was ridiculous. It was embarrassing. But I had. 13. Dead Man's Shoes.
Tony, are you all right?
Hawthorne was leaning over me, filling my vision. He didn't look concerned. If anything, he was puzzled, as if it was a strange thing to do, to faint after seeing a hideously mutilated and still bleeding corpse. I wasn't all right. I'd hit my head on Damien Cooper's warehouse-style floor, and I felt sick. The smell of blood was still in my nostrils, and I was afraid that I might have tumbled into it. Grimacing, I felt around me. The floorboards were dry.
"Can you help me up?" I said.
"Sure." He hesitated, then reached down and seized my arm, pulling me to my feet. Why the hesitation? Here was a moment of insight. In all the time I had known him, during this investigation, and while he had helped me with my research, there had never been any physical contact between us. We had never so much as shaken hands. In fact, now that I thought about it, I had never seen him come into physical contact with anyone. Was he a germaphobe? Or was he simply antisocial? It was another mystery for me to solve. I sat down in one of the leather armchairs, away from the body and the blood.
"Do you want some water?"
he asked.
"No, I'm okay."
"You're not going to throw up, are you? It's just that we have to protect the crime area."
"I'm not going to throw up," he nodded.
"It's not very nice, seeing a dead body. And I can tell you, this is about as bad as it gets."
He shook his head.
"I've seen decapitations, people with their eyes gouged out."
"Thanks." I could feel the nausea rising. I took a breath.
"Someone certainly didn't like Damien Cooper," he said.
"I don't get it," I said. I thought of what Grace had told us after the funeral. This was planned, wasn't it? Someone put the music player in the coffin because they knew it would get to Damien. They wanted to drive him away so he'd be on his own, but why him? If this is all about the accident in Deal, he can hardly take the blame. He wasn't even in the car.
"You've got a point."
I tried to think it through. A woman drives a car recklessly and kills a child. 10 years later, she is punished. But why extend that to her son? Could there be some biblical reason? An eye for an eye? That made no sense. Diana Cooper was already dead. If someone had wanted to use her son to hurt her, they would have killed him first. His mother didn't go to the police at first because she was trying to protect him, I mused. That was the reason why she drove away. Maybe it was enough to make him responsible. Hawthorne thought for a moment in silence, but not about what I'd said.
I've got to leave you for a minute, he said. I've already called 999, but I've got to check the flat.
Go ahead. Funnily enough, it was something I remembered from our time working on Injustice. We'd been talking about one of the scenes in Episode 1, when the animal rights activist is found dead in a farmhouse. Hawthorne had told me then that when a body is discovered, the first priority for any policeman or detective will be their own self-preservation. Are they under threat? Is the assailant still in the building? They'll make sure they're safe, then they'll look for possible witnesses. Classically, the child hiding in the wardrobe or under the bed. Hawthorne would have dialed 999 while I was lying on the floor. I suppose it was nice of him to notice me at all. He left the room, disappearing up the spiral staircase. I sat in the armchair, trying to ignore the body, trying not even to think of the dreadful injuries. It wasn't easy. If I closed my eyes, I became more aware of the smell. If I opened them, I found myself glimpsing the blood, the sprawled-out limbs. I had to turn my head away to keep Damien Cooper out of my line of vision. And then he groaned. I twisted round, thinking I'd imagined it. But there it was again, a quite gruesome, rattling sound. Damien's head was facing away from me, but I was quite certain it was coming from him. Hawthorne! I shouted. At the same time, I felt the bile rising in my throat. Hawthorne! He came, hurrying back down the stairs.
What is it?
It's Damien. He's alive. He looked at me doubtfully, then went over to the body.
No, he isn't, he said tersely.
I just heard him. Damien moaned again, louder this time. I hadn't imagined it. He was trying to speak. But Hawthorne just sniffed.
Stay where you are, Tony, and forget about it, all right? His muscles are stiffening, and that includes the muscles around his vocal cords. And there are gases in his stomach which are trying to escape. That's all you're hearing. It happens all the time.
Oh. I profoundly wished that I wasn't here. Not for the first time, I wished that I'd never agreed to write this bloody book. Hawthorne lit a cigarette.
Did you find anything upstairs? I asked.
There's no one else here, he said.
You knew he was going to be killed?
I knew it was a possibility.
How?
He cupped his hand and tapped ash into his palm. I could see that he was reluctant to tell me.
I was stupid, he said at last. But when the two of us were here the first time, you distracted me.
So it was my fault?
I told you, when I'm talking to someone, I need to focus. And when you interrupt, it sort of breaks what I'm thinking, my train of thought.
He softened.
It was my fault. I'll hold my hands up. I was the one who missed it.
Missed what?
Damien said that his mum came in and watered the plants on the terrace. He said she forwarded his mail. I should have remembered. When we were at Diana Cooper's place, there were 5 hooks in the kitchen. Do you remember?
They were on a wooden fish.
That's right. And there were 4 sets of keys. If Diana Cooper was coming in here while he was in L.A., it followed that she had his keys. But I didn't see one with that label.
There was an empty hook.
That's right. Someone kills her. They search the place. They notice the keys. They take the opportunity to snatch them.
He stopped, and I saw him playing back what he had just said.
That's one possibility, anyway.
I heard the stamp of feet on the stairs leading up to the front door, and a moment later, 2 uniformed police constables arrived. They looked from the body to the two of us, trying to work out what was going on.
Stay right where you are, the first one said. Who made the call?
I did, Hawthorne said. And you took your time getting here.
Who are you, sir?
Ex-Detective Inspective Hawthorne, formerly with MIT. I've already contacted D.I. Meadows. I've reason to believe that this murder may be connected to a current investigation. You'd better get in the local DI and the murder squad.
The British police have a particular way of addressing each other, a formal and slightly tortuous turn of phrase, as in, I have reason to believe, and contacted instead of called. It's one reason why I've always found them so difficult to dramatise on television. It's hard to care about a character who talks in clichés. They also look so much less interesting than their American counterparts, with their white shirts, stab vests, and those hopeless blue helmets. No guns, no sunglasses. These two policemen were young and earnest. One was Asian, the other white. They hardly spoke to us again. One of them took out his radio and called in the situation, while Hawthorne set about examining the room for himself. I watched him as he went over to the door that led out to the terrace. He was careful not to touch the handle, using a handkerchief which he pulled out of his pocket. The door was unlocked. He disappeared outside, and although I was still feeling dreadful, I hauled myself out of the chair and followed. The policemen had made their calls. They didn't seem to have anything else to do. They glanced uncertainly in my direction as I left. They hadn't even asked who I was. I felt better immediately being out in the afternoon air. Like the interior of the flat, the terrace, with its deck chairs, potted plants and gas barbecue, reminded me of a studio set. It resembled the balcony where Joey and Chandler and the rest of them used to hang out in Friends, looking out towards the back of the building with a metal fire escape leading to an alleyway. Hawthorne was standing at the edge, gazing down. I noticed he had taken off his shoes, presumably to avoid leaving footprints. He was smoking again. He consumed a suicidal number of cigarettes a day, at least 20, maybe more. He turned round as I approached.
"He was waiting out here," he said. "By the time Damien Cooper got back from the funeral, he'd already let himself into the flat using the keys he'd taken from Britannia Road. Then he came out here and he waited. But he also left this way when it was over."
"Wait a minute. How do you know all that? How do you even know it was a he?"
"Diana Cooper was strangled with a curtain cord. Her son was chopped to pieces. The killer was either a man or a really, really angry woman."
"What about the rest of it? How can you be sure that's how the murder happened?" Hawthorne just shrugged. "If you want me to write about it, you're going to have to tell me. Otherwise, I'll have to make it up." It was a threat I'd made before.
"All right."
He flicked the cigarette over the side of the building. I watched it spin in the air before it disappeared.
"Start by putting yourself in the killer's place. Think about what's going on in his mind. You know Damien's going to be coming back here from the funeral. That crap with the MP3 player and the wheels and the bus was done deliberately to drive him here. Or it could be that you were in the cemetery, in the crowd, or hiding behind one of the gravestones. You heard him tell his girlfriend, 'I'm going home.' That's when you made your plan. The only trouble is you can't be certain he's going to be alone. Maybe Grace will come along after all. Maybe he'll bring the vicar. So you have to wait somewhere you can see him, and if the opportunity doesn't present itself, you can piss off again." He jerked a thumb. "There's a staircase down to ground level."
"Perhaps he came up that way."
"He can't have. The door into the living room is locked and bolted on the inside."
Hawthorne shook his head.
"He had the key. He let himself in the front door. He looked for somewhere to hide and came out here. It was perfect. He could look in through the window and see if Damien had someone with him. But as things turned out, Damien was alone, which was what he wanted. The killer went back into the living room and..."
He left the rest of the sentence hanging. "You said he left this way too," I reminded him.
"There's a footprint."
Hawthorne pointed, and I saw a red quarter moon next to the fire escape, made by the sole of someone's shoe after they'd stepped in Damien's blood. It reminded me of the footprint we'd found at Diana Cooper's house, presumably left behind by the same foot.
"Anyway, he couldn't use the front door," Hawthorne went on. "You've seen the stab wounds. There'd have been a lot of blood. He'd have been covered in it. You think he could stroll down Brick Lane without being noticed? My guess is he'd put on a coat or something, climbed down here, and disappeared down the alleyway."
"Do you know how the alarm clock got into the coffin?"
"Not yet. We're going to have to talk to Cornwallis."
He rolled the cigarette between his fingers.
"But we're not going to be able to leave here for a while. You may have to give a statement to Meadows when he finally turns up. Don't say too much, just play dumb."
He glanced at me.
"It shouldn't be too difficult."
Over the next couple of hours, Damien Cooper's flat became more and more crowded, while the two of us sat there with nothing to do. The police constables who had first arrived on the scene had summoned their detective inspector, who had in turn called in the murder investigation team. There were about half a dozen of them, wearing those plasticized paper suits with hoods, masks and gloves that made them almost indistinguishable from each other. Every few seconds, the room seemed to freeze as a police photographer captured some section of it with a dazzling flash. A man and a woman, both part of the forensic team, were crouching over Damien's body, delicately swabbing his hands and neck with cotton buds. I knew what they were looking for. If there had been any bodily contact between Damien and his attacker during the knife attack, they might be able to pick up DNA. Both of his hands had been bagged, the opaque plastic securely taped. It was extraordinary how quickly he had been dehumanized, and worse was to come. When they were finally ready to remove him, two men knelt down and wrapped him in polythene, which they sealed with gaffer tape. The process turned him into something that reminded me of both ancient Egypt and Federal Express. They'd used blue and white tape to create a cordon, which began at the front door and blocked off the stairs. I wasn't sure how they would deal with the neighbours on the upper and lower floors. As for me, although I hadn't been questioned, a woman in a plastic suit had asked me to remove my shoes and taken them away. That puzzled me. "What do they need them for?" I asked Hawthorne. "Latent footprints," he replied. "They need to eliminate you from the inquiry." "I know, but they haven't taken yours." "I've been more careful, mate." He glanced at his feet. He was still in his socks. He must have slipped his shoes off the moment he saw Damien's body. "When will I get them back?" I asked. Hawthorne shrugged. "How long are we going to be here for?" Again, he didn't answer. He wanted another cigarette, but he wasn't allowed to smoke inside and it was making him irritable. After a while, Meadows arrived, signing himself in with the log officer at the door. He had taken charge. The murder of Damien Cooper was being folded into his current investigation, and this time I saw a different side of him. He was cool and authoritative, checking with the crime scene manager, talking to the forensic team, taking notes. When he finally came over to us, he got straight to the point.
"What were you doing here?"
"We came over to offer our condolences."
"Piss off, Hawthorne. This is serious. Did he call you? Did you know he might be in danger?"
Meadows wasn't as stupid as Hawthorne had suggested. He was right. Hawthorne had known. But would he admit it?
"No," he said. "He didn't call me." "So why did he come here? Why do you think?"
"That business at the funeral. There's obviously something sick going on, and if you hadn't been so busy chasing your non-existent burglar, you'd have seen it too. I wanted to ask him about what had happened. I just got here too late." No mention of the keys. Hawthorne would never admit he'd made a mistake. He'd forgotten that one day Meadows would read it in my book.
"He was already dead when he got here?"
"Yes."
"You didn't see anyone leaving?"
"There's a bloody footprint out on the terrace if you care to take a look. It might give you a shoe size."
"I'd say the killer left down the fire escape into the alley, so perhaps you'll catch him on CCTV. But we didn't see anything. We got here too late."
"All right then, you can get lost. And take Agatha Christie here with you." He meant me. Agatha Christie is something of a hero of mine, but I was still offended. Hawthorne got up, and I followed him to the front door, both of us padding across the wooden floor in our socks. I was about to point this out when he swept a pair of black leather shoes off the Art Deco sideboard and handed them to me. I hadn't noticed when he'd put them there.
"These are for you," he said.
"Where did you get them?"
"I nicked them out of the cupboard when I went upstairs. They belong to him."
He nodded in the direction of Damien Cooper.
"They should be about your size."
I looked uncertain, so he added,
"You won't be needing them."
I slipped them on. They were Italian, expensive. They fitted perfectly. He put on his own shoes, and we walked out, past more uniformed policemen and down into Brick Lane. There were three police cars parked outside, and next to them, a vehicle with the words "Private Ambulance" printed on the side. It wasn't anything of the sort. It was just a black van brought here to transport Damien Cooper to the mortuary. More policemen were at work, erecting a screen from the front of the house to the edge of the pavement so that nobody would see the body when it was carried out. A large crowd was being held back on the other side of the road. The traffic had been blocked. Not for the first time, I found myself thinking of all the television programs I'd been involved with. We'd never have been able to afford so many extras in all these vehicles, let alone the central London location. A taxi had pulled in just ahead of us, and I nudged Hawthorne as Grace Lavelle got out. She was dressed in the same clothes that she had worn to the funeral, with her handbag over her arm, but now she had Ashley with her, wearing a pink dress and clutching her hand. Grace stopped and looked around, shocked by all the activity. Then she saw us and hurried over. "What's happened?" she asked. "Why are the police here?"
"I'm afraid you can't go in there," Hawthorne said. "I've got some bad news."
"Damien?"
"He's been killed."
I thought he could have put it more gently. There was a 3-year-old girl standing in front of him. What if she had heard and understood? Grace had had the same thought. She drew her daughter closer towards her, a protective arm around her shoulders.
"What do you mean?"
she whispered.
"Someone attacked him after the funeral."
"He's dead?"
"I'm afraid so."
"No. That's not possible. He was upset. He said he was going home. It was that horrible joke."
She looked from Hawthorne to the door, then back again. She realised that the two of us had been on our way out.
"Where are you going?"
"There's a DI in the flat called Meadows. He's in charge of the investigation, and he'll want to talk to you. But if you'll take my advice, you won't go inside. It's not very pleasant. Have you been with your parents?"
"Yes, I went to pick up Ashley."
"Then get back in the taxi and go back to them. Meadows will find it soon enough."
"Can I do that? They won't think..."
"They won't think you had anything to do with it. You were at the pub with us."
"That's not what I meant."
She made up her mind, then nodded.
"You're right, I can't go inside, not with Ashley." "Where's Daddy?"
Ashley spoke for the first time. She seemed confused and scared by the police and all the activity around her.
"Daddy's not here," Grace said. "We're going back to Granny and Grandpa."
"Do you want someone to travel with you?" I asked. "I don't mind coming with you if you like."
"No, I don't need anyone."
I didn't know what to make of Grace Lavelle. I've never been very comfortable with actors, because I can never tell if they're being sincere or if they're simply, well, acting. This was how it was now. Grace looked upset. There were tears in her eyes. She could have been in shock. And yet there was a part of me that said it was all just a performance, that she'd been rehearsing her lines from the moment the taxi drew in. We watched as she got back into the car and closed the door. She leant forward and gave instructions to the driver. A moment later, it pulled away.
"The grieving widow," Hawthorne muttered.
"Do you think so?"
"No, Tony. I've seen more grief at a Turkish wedding. If you ask me, I'd say there's a lot of things she's not telling us."
The taxi passed through the traffic lights at the top of Brick Lane and disappeared. Hawthorne smiled.
"She didn't even ask how he died."
14. Wilsdon Green. It was a 1950s semi-detached house, red brick on the first floor, then off-white stucco topped with a gabled roof. It was as if three architects had worked on it at the same time, without ever being introduced to one another, but they must have been pleased with their work, because they'd replicated on the house next door, which was an exact mirror of its neighbour, with a wooden fence dividing the drives and a single chimney shared between the two properties. Each one of them had a bay window, which looked out over an area of crazy paving running down to a low wall, with a street, Snade Road, on the other side. I guessed it had about 4 bedrooms. A poster in the front window advertised a fun run for the North London Hospice. A garage stood open to one side, with a bright green Vauxhall Astra, a tricycle, and a motorbike fighting for space. The doorway was arched, the door fake medieval, with thick panels of frosted glass. There was a novelty welcome mat which read, "Never mind the dog, beware of the owner." When Hawthorne pressed the doorbell, it played the opening notes of the theme from Star Wars. Chopin's funeral march might have been more appropriate. For this was where Robert Cornwallis lived. The woman who opened the door was almost aggressively cheerful, as if she had been looking forward to our visit all week. "There you are at last," she seemed to say as she beamed out at us. "What took you so long?" She was about 40 years old and was hurtling into middle age with complete recklessness, actually embracing it with a baggy, out-of-shape jersey, ill-fitting jeans with a flower embroidered on one knee, frizzy hair and cheap, chunky jewellery. She was overweight, an earth mother, she might call herself. She had a huge pile of laundry under one arm and a cordless telephone in her hand, but didn't seem to notice either of them. I could imagine her balancing the laundry on her raised thigh with a phone squeezed between her ear and her shoulder as she struggled to open the door. "Mr. Hawthorne?" she asked, looking at me. She had a pleasant, well-educated voice. "No," I said. "That's him." "I'm Barbara. Please come in. I'm afraid you're going to have to excuse the state of the house. It's 6 o'clock and we're just putting the children to bed. Robert's in the other room. I'm sure you'll understand we've had a bit of a day. Irene told us what happened at the funeral. It's shocking. You're with the police, is that right?"
"I'm helping the police with this inquiry."
"This way. Mind the roller skate. I've told the children not to leave them in the hall. One day someone's going to break their neck." She glanced down, noticing the laundry for the first time. "Oh, look at me. I'm so sorry. I was just putting on the wash when the door rang. I don't know what you must think of me." We stepped over the loose roller skate and went into a hallway cluttered with coats, Wellington boots and different sized shoes. A motorbike helmet sat on a chair. Two children were racing around the house. We heard them before we saw them, screaming, high-pitched voices. A second later, they came charging out of a doorway, two little boys, both fair-haired, aged about 5 and 7. They took one look at us, then turned round and disappeared, still screaming. "That's Toby and Sebastian," Barbara said. "They'll be going up for their bath in a minute, and then maybe we'll get a bit of peace. Do you have children? Honestly, sometimes this place is like a battlefield." The children had taken over the house. There were clothes on radiators, toys everywhere, footballs, plastic swords, stuffed animals, old tennis rackets, scattered playing cards, and pieces of Lego. It was difficult to see past the mess, but as we were shown through an archway and into the living room, I got the impression of a comfortable, old-fashioned home, with dried flowers in the fireplace, seagrass carpets, an upright piano that would almost certainly be out of tune, throws on the sofas, and those round paper lampshades that never seemed to have gone completely out of fashion. The pictures on the walls were abstract and colourful, the sort of art that might have come out of a department store.
"Do you work in your husband's business, Mrs. Cornwallis?"
Hawthorne asked as we followed her towards the kitchen.
"God, no. And call me Barbara."
She dumped the laundry on a chair.
"We see enough of each other as it is. I'm a pharmacist, part-time, local branch of Boots. Can't say I love that either, but we have to pay the bills. Watch out, that's the other roller skate. Robert's in here."
The kitchen was bright and cluttered, with a breakfast bar and a white, rustic-style table. Dirty plates were piled up in the sink, with clean ones beside them. I wondered how Barbara would be able to sort out which was which. French windows looked out over a garden that was little more than a green rectangle, with a few shrubs growing down one side, boxed in by fences. Even this had been colonised by the children, with a trampoline and a climbing frame occupying and killing much of the lawn. Robert Cornwallis, in the same suit that he had worn at the Brompton Chapel, but without the tie, was sitting at the table going through some accounts. It was strange seeing him here, a funeral director outside his parlour. At least, it was strange because I knew he was a funeral director. I wondered what it was like to come home to this cosy domestic normality after a day stitching up bodies in the morgue. Did he or his wife feel in any way tainted by it? Did his children know what their father did? I've never actually had an undertaker as a character in any of my books, and I was rather hoping that Hawthorne would ask him more about his work. I store all sorts of information like that. You never know when it may be useful. The kitchen had been invaded like the rest of the house. There were more plastic toys, crayons and paper on the table. Brightly coloured scribbles sellotaped onto every wall. I remembered the house in Harrow-on-the-Hill and Judith Godwin's life, destroyed by the loss of a child. The Cornwallis's house was defined by children too, but in a very different way. "Here's Robert," Barbara announced, then chided him.
"Are you still doing that? We've got the supper to cook, and the children to put to bed, and now we've got the police in the house."
"I've just finished, dear." Cornwallis closed his account books. He gestured at the empty seats in front of him. "Mr. Hawthorne, please sit down."
"Would you like some tea?" Barbara asked. "I can offer you English breakfast, Earl Grey, or Lapsang Souchong."
"Nothing, thank you."
How about something stronger, maybe? Robert, we've still got that wine in the fridge.
I shook my head.
I might have a glass, if you don't mind. After all, it's the weekend, almost. Will you have one, Robbie?
No, thank you, dear. Hawthorne and I sat down on the other side of the table. Hawthorne